Welcome to The Report Card with Nat Malkus, the education policy podcast from the American Enterprise Institute. My guest today is David Steiner. David is the executive director of the Johns Hopkins Institute for Education Policy and was previously the dean of the School of Education at Hunter College and the commissioner of education for New York State. David Steiner is also the author of A Nation at Thought, Restoring Wisdom in America's Schools. David Steiner, welcome to the report card.
Many thanks, Nat.
So, David, you've written quite a bit and a good bit about national systems of education. I want to start about one, admittedly non-random point you've written. You say a system is defined as coherent when the national curriculum, content, textbooks, teaching content, pedagogy, assessment, drivers, and incentives are all aligned and reinforce one another. Why is coherence so important?
Fragmentation tends to be a system that sinks to its lowest common denominator. So, for example, we cannot in this country prepare teachers to teach a given content because we have no idea what content they'll teach. Thus, they arrive on day one at a given school. A huge textbook is dropped on their desk, or some other teacher gives them their notes from the previous year, and they basically are told to sink or swim. In most countries, because there's a national or provincial curriculum, the teacher preparation programs can prepare teachers for what they're going to teach. Take our ELA exams. The one thing we know in this country, with the exception of Louisiana, in a pilot, is that the text that appears on that ELA exam will be something you've never read before. What happens is that wealthy kids who have lots of background knowledge are far more likely to know what that passage is about, and they do well. Poor kids do badly. In other countries, the playing field is leveled. Everyone studies the same materials and then are tested on their ability to analyze and be reflective about those texts. And I could go through each of the elements and show the same thing. Fragmentation simply means that one part of the system doesn't handshake with the other, and the victims are our kids.
So let me ask you this, because in America, we have this, you know, federalist education society, right? We got 50 states, we have 50 systems of education. And you could say, well, they're not coherent because Massachusetts isn't doing what Florida is doing. Is that what you're saying?
No, it's worse than that. Massachusetts isn't doing what Massachusetts is doing. In other words, there isn't a Massachusetts curriculum. Even in Louisiana, where 90% plus of the kids actually do study the same curriculum in ELA and in math, there are still some districts which are rogue, as it were, and blend stuff together and decide that they know better. And as a result, we can't have a simple assessment on the curriculum that 9 out of 10 children in that state study. But in every other state, it's worse.
So to get a coherent system, even if we're talking about a coherent state
system,
is the thing that we need top-down education contents, directives, and we need a top-down solution?
We need a small number of curriculum in the major subjects. That way we can pre-prepare teachers to teach that curriculum. We can test that curriculum. We can do professional development around that curriculum. It shouldn't be one, but it could be 5. And in fact, in Tennessee, in Louisiana, a couple of other states, we are moving in that direction. It is simply that the state is very frightened about mandating it. So there are always going to be these tiny exceptions, even in those states.
So let me repeat back what I've heard. I mean, instead of, well, there's one rule and it's my way or the highway coming from the state, it could be, well, you have several options you can choose from, but look, these are all similar enough that it's going to create a coherence between the curriculum taught, what teachers do in their classrooms, and sort of the state expectations for what students should know and learn.
Yes, absolutely.
And so when we look internationally, are there countries that do this well?
Yes, most of them. In fact, if you look at anywhere from Germany, which is divided into a few what we would call states, they have a different word for it. France has a national curriculum. England, where I grew up, had in fact a number of examination boards that were not run by the state. They were authorized by the state, and the state simply guaranteed that the exams were of equal difficulty. But the schools could choose which board's exams to choose from and to examine. So it's not about one size fits all, but it is about constrained choice for the sake of kids.
So let me offer some pushback here from PISA scores. So if you look at U.S. in math, not doing so hot. However, in 2022, in reading and science, you know, we actually do okay. In reading, we're ranked ninth ahead of U.K., France, Finland, Sweden, Denmark, Norway, Germany, Switzerland, Australia, Netherlands, and Belgium. And yes, I read that from a list. In science, we're ranked 16th, above many of the same. I get that it's better to have a coherent system, but how much more improvement would we expect?
Well, first of all, we have made progress in reading. The work around the science of reading is really encouraging. I would actually point to it as the most coherent thing that's happened in American education in the last decade. There is a surprising, finally, consensus around the fact that there is actually a way to teach kids to read. And Mississippi, perhaps surprisingly, but under wonderful leadership of Kerry Wright, led the way. And frankly, you now have to explain why you're not using it rather than why you are. And we're seeing the results. Look, Mississippi had the second highest improvement in the United States. In the old days, you know, if you were in Louisiana, you said, thank goodness for Mississippi, because it's always going to be worse. So our reading scores are going up, and for very good reason. Our mathematics is disastrous. And frankly, where we are moving to coherence, you see the evidence. Where we are not, you see the problem.
So this seems counterintuitive to me, that in reading we would have progress in coherence and not in math. Because to some degrees, there's some inherent coherence in how you might teach math.
I agree with you. Though, in fact, if you recall, Nat, there was a huge split in the math world. Remember the NCTM versus, right? It really was extraordinary when I would try to explain to people abroad that America couldn't agree fundamentally on how to teach math. But it was true. And the problem right now is that if you look at math curriculum, which I have, and you look at the same mathematical operation, the way that the textbook suggests it's taught is totally different. We are having this problem with tutoring. So much of the research that my former colleague, now sadly deceased, Bob Slavin, found to be true was that tutoring was very powerful, right? Yeah. But we put a lot of tutoring in after COVID, and we've had very, very lumpy results. Why? In part because the tutors are using their own math approach, their own math curriculum, which is not integrated. Again, lack of coherence with what's being taught in the school, right? And what the kids are getting when they're pulled out or pushed in, again, can be different. So there is this seemingly this resistance to the idea that we could actually get together on a good math curriculum.
So let me posit a couple of things. Let's just stipulate that there are two divergent ways, or multiple, but let's just say right now, for two divergent ways that you could design curriculum on reading. Right. And one may be better than the other one. Would you think that we would have better results from a coherent system teaching either, if one was just marginally better, rather than a system that teaches both?
Absolutely. Yes. I mean, in the end, the reading issue is a little more complicated because there's learning to read, where we're making a lot of progress, and there's reading to learn. And I think the difference there is that we have a science of reading. We don't have a science of reading to learn. And the problem is that by the time we get to high school, the results are all over the lot, frankly. And when we look at the 12th grade results versus 4th grade results, we see the divergence of the SES, right? So the poor kids, the gap between them and the wealthier kids is growing the longer they stay in school, right, after 4th grade, as the differences in background knowledge, in rigor, in the quality of the text they're reading really come to the forefront.
So We had something on order about 12 years ago that was I thought was going to fix all this, and that was the Common Core. And so I'm sure many of our listeners are scratching their heads saying, David, we had the fix on this. Was Common Core designed to fix this?
No. Common Core was a skills-based set of standards. Now, you could say, well, what's the problem, right? The skill of find the main idea. There's a skill in the Common Core, right, in ELA, universal. And you say, well, there's the coherence. Well, here's the problem. If I say to you, the silly mid-off missed the consequences of the googly, please give me the main idea. You'd look at me blankly. Every 10-year-old in England would tell me immediately what the main idea is. Why? Because they know that this is about cricket, a national game. My point is that the skill of find the main idea actually is empty. What it really says is, do you understand what the passage is about? And that's curriculum, right? That's content. So there was no standardization of what matters most. There was simply a proxy, namely the substitute of skill for curriculum. Let me give you an example. David Coleman, the main architect of the Common Core in ELA, in front of me when I was commissioner in New York and a very large audience, said that the best way of thinking about a good reader was a detective. Now, I thought about that, and I thought about it for a long time ever since. What is the solution to War and Peace, to Moby Dick, to The Bluest Eye? There's a category mistake there. There's a mistake of thinking that the skill of reading is a skill that solves a problem. No, it's interpretation, right? So the problem with the Common Core in ELA is that it was an attempt to bypass our disagreements about content, but it ended up just perpetuating the big divide.
So I think that this might be sort of pregnant in that answer, but where's the pushback on coherence? I mean, like, is there a anti-coherence
group? There is. And it's come from several places. So the first is a very old belief, really going right back to the progressives, right, to John Dewey, the father of many sins, where the belief is that if I don't invent my curriculum for my children, it's not authentic. That's the word, right? That I know my children, my kids, my pupils better than anyone else, so I'm the one who should be designing the curriculum. That's like Meryl Streep saying, I won't act in this movie because I didn't write the script. She has the good sense to say, I want the best possible script so that my skills as an actress can rise to the top. The skill of writing a curriculum and the skill of teaching a curriculum are utterly different, but they've gotten conflated. So that's the first source. The second is much more recent, and that is the politics of identity, or identity politics, right? So an organization like Great Minds, which publishes one of the most used new curriculum, Wit and Wisdom, has to create a different curriculum for use in certain Texas cities than it does in Baltimore, out of respect, right, for the different populations. There isn't a belief in this country that what is universally of high quality is everyone's birthright, right? If you look at what Malcolm X studied in prison, if you look at what Martin Luther King studied at Boston University, if you look at the great tradition of African-American radical thought, it's steeped in what we would call the great books. They didn't find them conservative.
Right.
But that view is out of fashion, right? Today, and the superintendent of public schools in Baltimore puts it this way. She says, the curriculum has to have mirrors. Now, she also says windows. That part gets often forgotten.
Right.
But we are very big on, you know, finding ourselves in our curriculum. And that means fragmentation again. It's an odd idea. If we think about the word education, you know, etymologies are sometimes useful. It means to draw out, right? The idea is that you're born not knowing very much beyond right. your instincts. Education is supposed to introduce you to the great vistas of science and poetry, of mathematics and history, things you cannot possibly know about because you're a human being. But now, no, we think you're not so much a human being as you are a faith or a color of skin or a geographic location.
So you mentioned you were commissioner of the state of New York, right? Not New York City Schools, New York State.
Yes.
Were you able to create a more coherent system when you were commissioner in New York?
No.
So why not? I knew that was the answer. Right, why not, right. David?
Because when I came to that office, we were in the middle of the rage over Common Core, right? There was enormous pressure for states to adopt it. You may recall, it was basically a condition for the low-hanging fruit of Race to the Top.
Right, which was a bunch of federal money.
Now, what I tried to do, and I think I was the only commissioner to do it, is that I insisted that $23 million on our application for $700 million would be spent on curriculum, on high-quality curriculum. That became Engage New York, which was the first high-quality, free online curriculum in math and ELA. And I, of all the things I did and didn't do as commissioner, that one I'm proud of,
right,
because everyone told me not to do it. My simple thought was, Common Core is about standards, but teachers don't teach standards. They teach stuff. They teach content.
Content.
So that was my effort. And indeed, after, I think these are RAND figures, after 4 years, the downloads were over 150 million. So clearly, teachers were responding to this idea of a really good curriculum. But it was, of course, voluntary.
Yeah. So, you know, you're a state commissioner or a superintendent.
Yeah.
You have a vision. You're trying to move a large institution, set of institutions, really, to do something different. You have some kind of coherent vision. For those who haven't been in a spot, how do you explain? Where does the resistance come from? Why is that job so difficult?
It starts with teacher prep, right? I have the scars. I was dean of a very large school of education for 8 years, was proud to work with some very good charter organizations, KIPP, Uncommon Achievement First, to develop a video-based clinical training, but by and large, schools of education aren't focused on teaching. It's a very odd thing to say,
right,
but they are focused on sort of the quasi-philosophy of education. And they are deeply, deeply committed to the view that they are going into a victimized world. That is to say, most of the graduates who will go into public school education are convinced that the system is rigged against their kids, that they are, in a sense, at the wrong end of the stick, economically, socially, culturally. They're not entirely wrong, but that sense of being done in by the system and therefore wanting to push back, understandably, makes them in many ways, and this is a culture and an ideology that the schools of education push,
right,
they're more interested in being social warriors often than in saying, well, I've got to master the science of reading. The latest evidence we have is that 23 years after the publication of the National Reading Panel, which gave us all the evidence we need, it's still true that over 45% of schools of education aren't preparing their reading teachers, the teachers who will teach reading, in the science of reading. It's an astonishing fact, but it's symptomatic of a much larger problem. So that's the first challenge. I did try to work on certification issues. That is politically one of the third rails,
right,
because the ed schools are spread among the political entities of the state. Each one has a senator. Ed schools traditionally are cash cow. Right?
For the university.
For the university.
Yes.
And the universities are cash cows, right? So that's one problem. The second problem is that we had in this country 113,000 school boards. We still have thousands upon thousands, right? Long Island has over 100 school districts. Those are proudly, proudly particularistic, right? So when I wanted to close the high school in Roosevelt, Long Island, because of very, very challenging results for many years, right, and bust the kids to the white districts around it, found out that was politically impossible,
right?
It was, a third rail. So local pressure, not in my backyard, right, is the second source of localism. And there were superintendents Long Island whose salaries were far higher than mine as a commissioner, right? It wasn't clear to me they were linked to academic performance. I won't go into a long list of what they were linked to. So that's a second. The third one, I think, is our history, right? We are a gloriously heterogeneous society. But as a result, we don't have a civil war. We have a civil war in Boston. We have a war between the states in Washington, D.C., and we have the war of northern aggression in rural Alabama, right? We can't agree on what we are. And that means that, for example, in many history exams that states give, they're not actually examining history knowledge. They give you the knowledge build in the assessment and then ask you questions about it. So the history exam becomes a comprehension test. Why is that? Because they don't really want to take the risk of establishing a substantive single narrative of history.
So it strikes me that in much of this talk about the curriculum, yeah, that the content and the authority to establish the content, yes, is really the tough thing. Yes. Whereas if you could come from on high, right, whoever that may be, right, and say, this is what your children need to know,
yes,
then a coherent system flowing from there is much easier to build.
Absolutely.
But we don't have that touchstone.
We don't. And that does go to our heterogeneity. When I was a kid, our teachers in England, and I went to a state school, I do not believe that once did our English master ask himself, why am I teaching Shakespeare? It would not have been a conceivable question, right? Of course you taught Shakespeare, right? Of course you taught George Eliot. Of course you taught Chaucer. These were of courses, right? And of course in history you taught Queen Elizabeth I and Henry VIII and, right, the Tudors and Queen Victoria and the glorious victories in World War I and II. There was no national debate about the content.
But it strikes me that it's even more different than you're characterizing it, because, yeah, you're saying, well, they wouldn't doubt it. My thought is that by and large, they would see themselves as the transmitter of why you need to know this.
Yeah.
That would be, they're not only sort of like the reflector, they're actually the active agent to say, child, to become an adult, you need to learn
to
these
become
things.
An educated,
sure,
adult. Yes,
right.
I think that's right. That is, there were certain things, you're not educated if you haven't read a Shakespeare play.
So we've talked a lot about the incoherence of, right, these large public school systems. To what extent, and this isn't a trick question, this isn't, right, a, you know, AI, right, is a big supporter of private school choice, but,
right,
it raises the question. This just sort of seems to be arranging itself as an argument for charter schools, for private school choice programs, where because it's sort of smaller and more atomistic, it may not be systemically coherent,
right,
but at least the individual institutions are coherent. Am I,
right,
off?
No. There's no question that a coherent school culture, where at least the community is centered on an agreed mission and therefore an agreed content, agreed style of teaching, is a huge advantage. And by the way, that's true of a religious school, a Marxist school, a Montessori school. It's independent of the thing itself. It's the coherence that's doing it. So that's the first point. The second point is, I think the problem with choice is not fundamentally that, there's something glorious about our current public school system. What we want to avoid, no matter what, whether it's public schools or public charter schools or private schools, is a choice between the equivalent of McDonald's, Wendy's, and Burger King. Right? If that's what choice becomes for poor parents, that's not something, I take it, you would endorse. Right? So we're making a gamble on the supply. Now, of course, the answer is, but look what they have now. Right? And that's a tough counter.
Sure.
Right? So I think the fundamental point you're making is correct, which is, all else being equal, a tight mission is always going to benefit.
But fair enough to your point that, right, that doesn't mean the ensuing supply, right,
just comes miraculously, deus ex machina.
Let me turn a bit to something else. You've,
sure,
been, I think it's safe to say, fairly critical of some trends like social-emotional learning, the idea of teaching grit or growth. mindset. You, I think, have called these things distractors.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
Okay. So quickly, on social and emotional, which is the one I'm always pushed back on the hardest.
Right.
We'll get to the rest because they're easier in a moment. I've been very clear that not only post-COVID, it actually was true before, there is a mental health crisis, right? There is a lot of good evidence that adolescents in this country who are on average looking at social media 8 hours a day are screwing up their minds, right?
Go figure. I'm puzzled.
What a strange thing, yes. Right? And when that gets serious, and it does, and we have suicide rates that are rising, they need professional help. They need mental health professionals. We have actually some good research out of England that shows when teachers try to do that out of the goodness of their heart, they do more damage than good.
So the amateur hour social emotional learning is not going to deliver what you expected.
And on the other side of the extreme with social emotional, when it means be encouraging, be supportive, right? Don't tell a kid that the reason they did badly in the math test is they suck at math, right? Tell them that you're going to work with them and they're going to work harder next time and they're going to do better. I think that's called good teaching. I don't think we need a new science for that. So at either extreme, I have a difference, right? So that's on social and emotional. On things like 21st century skills, and I did a lot of work on this for my book, the lists are endless, right? Anything you like can end up on that list,
right?
Critical thinking. I used to annoy people, and I still do, by asking my audiences to close their eyes, take a deep breath, and think critically for the next 30 seconds about nothing in particular. My point, of course, is that you can't think critically about something if you have nothing to think about. The reason we compensate surgeons and pilots and software engineers the way we do is because they have a lot of content knowledge to think critically about. So the idea that you can somehow bypass content and just teach critical thinking is frankly just nonsense.
So the content knowledge is key here. It's been a through thread of our whole conversation.
Yeah.
And what a lot of people think of content knowledge, they think of Edie Hirsch, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But your views are a little different than Edie Hirsch's. So first of all, in case folks don't know, this is David Steiner's characterization of Edie Hirsch's take on content knowledge. Tell us, what was Edie Hirsch's perspective on this?
Yeah.
And how does yours differ?
So first of all, I have enormous admiration for Edie Hirsch. And for K5, K6, his work has been seminally important.
And his work was just briefly
basically to say there has to be a basic core knowledge, right, that underprivileged kids don't get access to and must get access to if they're going to build that knowledge in the future.
And he named it, right?
He said, look,
this is what
this is it. And it was interesting how he did it. He looked at the New York Times. He looked at professional speak, the kind of circles that underprivileged kids would love to be in, but often never get access to. And he said, look, they need that vocabulary. They need to know that it's like a passport to a country, right? No passport, no entry. And so he codified it. And then he and his team, and I was on the board for many years and privileged to be so, built that up. The problem comes when you extrapolate that into the higher grades. Now that he was playing with 6-8, it's not clear quite where the line comes. But his view of text is very close to a kind of quasi-scientific view. He goes back to a very old tradition of, let's use a fancy word, hermeneutics, where the idea of reading a text is to understand what the author thought they meant.
Right.
So you can pin it down. So there's an answer. We're back with Coleman and his detective. And to me, that is such a misreading of what interpretation is. And we just have a deep scholarly disagreement. I've read his much, much older scholarly work. He was a professor of literature, right, at University of
Virginia.
On
hermeneutics, right?
On hermeneutics, he published. And he had a long difference with a very great German thinker, Hans-Georg Gadamer, whose work on hermeneutics, I think, is brilliant. And Hirsch by the way, in this, he's a Straussian, interestingly. Alan Bloom had the same belief, that the idea was you would find the intention. It's sort of like an originality in the Supreme Court, right?
Sure.
Let's get inside
the
mind.
He was an originalist.
He was an originalist.
Sure.
And I think for serious reading of older students, that's a disaster.
So in your book, A Nation on Thought, you talk a little bit about this hierarchy of subject matter in schools.
Yes.
And look, there's a lot going into this, but the top of the heap are math and whatever you want to call it. English language arts is the typical name. Science and history are a little lower down. Art is sort of at the floor, right?
Right.
It's in the basement.
Foreign languages,
right? No windows.
Art,
that's right.
And then economics, philosophy, kind of nowhere.
What's wrong with that hierarchy?
It's a disaster. And I really mean that technically, right? So if you are taking an A level in England, which is your high school test, you can take it.
So A levels in England are a high school test to determine sort of where your secondary options
are. Exactly.
Lie. Okay.
Usually what happens is the university that you want to get into tells you in advance what grade you need, right? Which, by the way, is called an incentive. Our state tests don't have them. Another fragmentation problem, right? Non-coherence between K-12 and higher ed. But getting back to the point, they actually enable you to take, depending on your school, and you can do some things online, 30, 40 different subjects. So if you're absolutely drawn to the arts, your A-level in the arts matches in quality and importance an A-level in English language arts or math. If you are drawn to economics, my goodness, why shouldn't you study economics, right? Why philosophy? Whatever it may be, we have decided, for reasons I still don't understand, that the world was created such that science belongs below math, right? That political economy, which one might argue is the most important body of knowledge for citizens to have, it's Adam Smith, it's the world we live in, is barely taught at all. It's home ec, which is a nonsense, right? This is narrowing with a vengeance. This is a class system of subjects. And, you know, unless you're brilliant at the arts and you're going to Juilliard, right, to play the violin, and that's a tiny percentage, right, those top academies, right, more vicious to get into than the Ivy League, you have no way of showing that ability in terms of something that's going to interest the university. Very frankly, when I did my A-levels, I chose the topics, the subject matter, that I thought I would do well in, that I enjoyed. And if I'd had to do, you know, some other subjects, I would never have gone to Oxford.
Hmm. So let me push back a little bit here.
Yeah.
Because I know that there's a bunch of folks who will say, hold on a second. That may be all and good for high school, but look, mathematics unlocks the sciences for the vast majority of sciences. Mm-hmm. You can't get through chemistry without a decent grounding in math. And how are you supposed to learn political economy if you can't read? And,
right, but we're confusing topics here.
Well, let's get them in order then.
So, of course, you need to learn to read.
Sure.
And that's supposed to happen by about the end of second grade.
Right.
Right. Of course, you need some basic math. We can say it's by the end of fifth grade. Well, we can argue about exactly where. But actually, you don't need advanced math to do what the British would call A-level chemistry or A-level biology. You need very advanced math to do string theory. But how many people, right?
Not many.
Right. I ask your audience, how many of them have used algebra beyond A plus B equals C in the last year, right? Still fewer, I suspect, geometry, trigonometry. I mean, why on earth are we teaching geometry? I mean that as a serious question. Because they did in the 16th century? I have no idea. And most people don't enjoy it. And a lot of people aren't very good at it. And if they had a paintbrush in their hand or they were able to do coding, right, for an exit exam, if they were able to do statistics, which is arguably far more relevant to modern life, they might enjoy it more, they might be better at it. But no, we're going to put them in front of Euclid.
I will submit to the entire audience that you would all enjoy statistics on a daily basis. But aside from my personal preferences, let me ask you whether a lot of this hierarchy of math and ELA comes from a perspective, and this is me venturing a theory.
Sure.
That we have to shore up the floor in American schools. And if we have a lot of kids who aren't reading on grade level and we have a lot of kids who aren't doing very well in math, then those are the first floors to shore up and everything is downstream of those objectives. Is that a fair characterization?
It's a fair characterization of what we may believe. I don't actually agree with it. So it,
no, but how we got here.
Absolutely. But if you're in sixth grade, and by the way, I've been in a lot of schools in the last 6 months where the sixth grade ELA teachers are in despair because they weren't taught how to teach reading, how to teach learning to read, and they have kids who can't read in sixth grade. Now, you probably need to figure out what might interest a child of that age, right, in reading, and not pretend that they're 7 years old. Right. And treat them that way. So it's a very complicated subject. But you are right. There's a feeling of if at first you don't succeed, right, hammer your head against the wall forever.
And then the upper echelons of students, the students who have passed those bars.
Yeah.
Get relatively less enrichment than we might had we organized it differently.
Yes, absolutely.
All right, David, we have a section in the podcast called Grade It. I'm going to offer you something. You're supposed to give me a grade and a very brief explanation. Are you ready? Career and technical education.
C minus. We are still in a woodworking, hairdressing mode in far too many places. We have world-class CTE in particular high schools, and I've been privileged to see them. You know, world-class robotics, flight simulators. We also have dead-end options in far, far too many schools.
All right. Advanced placement and international baccalaureate programs. The opposite end of the spectrum, perhaps.
I would give it a mixed grade. The British have a grade called Beta Plus Query Plus, which means almost an A. It's not that there's some fundamental problem with the assessment. The problem is that for underprivileged kids, those kind of tests come very late. They suddenly get an option, if they are lucky enough, to be in those AP classes. They're not prepared for them. And as you and I know, they disproportionately do very poorly in them. So we have to build runways.
Filming teachers for training purposes.
I pressed that on Hunter College, where I was dean, the School of Education. I thought it was essential. We ended up with about 14,000 videos. And I would sit with prospective teachers and stop the tape and watch them in tears, watching themselves. I believe in it. I think it's fundamentally important. I think in the end, teaching is a performance. And watching yourself teach, watching the reactions of your students is one of the most powerful ways to learn.
And without it, do teachers get a chance to actually see themselves reflected on the stage?
They're often in the classroom for one semester, and they're supervised by two adults who not only have no training in them for each of them, but aren't cross-trained. In other words, they may be giving completely contradictory advice to the poor student teacher.
National support and funding for the arts in the United States.
D-. I was privileged to be Director of Education for the National Endowment for the Arts before I became Dean at Hunter. And I did some awful calculation, which got me nowhere in terms of the approval of my colleagues, where I've calculated on a 24-hour basis that the Pentagon was spending our annual budget in about an hour. It is extraordinary that the National Center for Arts Education had at that point, you know, a rounding error of a budget in D.C. I loved my colleagues. I loved the work. It's crucially important. And it's talk about that hierarchy of subjects. It's right at the bottom.
Nearby, the state of music education.
Same problem, right? I mean, we had an Oscar awarded to a film about repairing musical instruments in Los Angeles. And suddenly that repair shop is evidently floating.
Bursting at the seams.
Wonderful, wonderful. But goodness, why do we need a film, right? I mean, you know, it's one of the things I was always struck about KIPP, the charter schools, that they had a string orchestra in the schools. They made that happen. And the children talk about it. Music, arts, physical education, right? I mean, we have many, many schools where that, frankly, doesn't exist. And the kid's supposed to sit there from the time they arrive to the time they leave, and you wonder why there's no attention.
Masters pay premiums for teachers.
Not a good idea. I was part of something called the Kerwin Commission in Maryland, which, as you know, meets on a it's actually required by the legislature every so often to plan the funding and policy for the state. And I looked again at the research, because you have to be research driven. And there simply isn't any that says, you know, the possession of a master's is automatically going to make you a better teacher, or even very likely to make you a better teacher. There is evidence that the national board process seems to, it doesn't necessarily make you a better teacher, but those who go through it tend to be proud, rightly, of their craft and do well. So we substituted that for the master's as a target for teachers to aspire to. But the master's itself is frankly a way for schools of ed to, you know, to continue to draw students. I think if it were more clinical, it could be made valuable.
Could be.
Could be.
Not. And still not. In Maryland, are teachers with master's degrees still getting
It's a shift. It's going to take a couple of years.
Okay. American expectations for K-12 students.
Depressing. C minus and getting worse. This is something, as you know, that I talk about in the book a lot. Doug Lamov had a very interesting piece about this recently, about the fact that we're more worried about math anxiety than we are about math achievement. The Chinese, as he said, must be laughing at us, right? We somehow feel that grades have become, you know, a bad idea. So we simply give everybody an A minus. GPAs have risen without a trace. And university GPAs are happily keeping pace. We simply call success what we used to call failure. When you do that, you reinforce the bigotry of low expectations.
The character Steiner in Fellini's La Dolce Vita.
Pass.
Having students learn ancient Greek.
It's totally unnecessary as a requirement. It is wonderful to offer it.
But you can't get it anywhere now.
But you can't get it. The problem is not that it's not, you know, required. That's absurd. But it goes back to the narrowing, right? When Nelson Mandela was plonked in prison, and at that point he could have expected a lifetime, right? He chose the play Antigone for the Christmas play. And he chose to play the role of Creon, who is the tyrant in that play. And when he was asked later, you know, you had all these choices. You could have chosen something by an African, right? He said that play taught him more about what despotic rule was, more about the politics of power than anything else he could find, right? The reason for looking at great texts through history, from wherever they come, from whatever culture, whatever language, is that we shouldn't be arrogant enough to think we happen to have a monopoly on wisdom because we've arrived today.
And this last one, and it is not because you mentioned despotic power, teachers' unions.
They were under Alshanka a force for good. Unquestionably, they can be. I think that they've become the victim of their own structures to some degree. What I mean by that is because of the way the voting works, the power of those who are retired has often now overwhelmed the needs of young teachers. So that a place like New York City spends more money on its retirees, right, than it does on its active teachers. And the way the structure of the profession works, it's essentially a promise of early retirement and then a decent pension rather than a really attractive profession. Now, there are states that are working with unions to change that. We, through the Kerwin Commission, are going to change the salary schedule. So it can be done. But I think there are some structural issues that pit unions against important reforms that are frustrating and off the record, often frustrating to the union folks themselves.
All right. Thanks for giving some grades. David, do you think school is boring?
In many cases, that is absolutely what they are. When I see the head go on the desk, something just drops in my stomach. I've had the privilege of being in many, many schools, and some of them in some of the toughest neighborhoods. I did not see a lot of cases of people punching out each other. Of course, that happens, and it's a mess. Far, far more often.
But you're saying that's not the primary
problem. That's not the primary problem. The primary problem is they're checking out. And it's not just chronic absenteeism, which is a concern right now, and you're an expert on it. It is internal absenteeism, mental absenteeism, just falling asleep. What I now see in many urban classrooms is a small circle of kids around the teacher who are trying to learn and being taught, and then a wider circle of kids on their iPhones, their smartphones, totally checked out. And the implicit contract is, you don't bother us, we don't bother you.
So what do you think it takes to turn this around?
Well,
or what's your best bet?
My feeling, first of all, goes back to let's offer subject matter that actually is of interest to 21st century young people, right? I mean, ability to create a multimedia presentation that is toughly graded. Now, there's something worth learning how to do, right, on a subject that matters, rather than, you know, doing another worksheet and filling in the blank. Hamlet was confused because A, B, C, or D. No. So, and then secondly, and it's the same problem, teachers who aren't themselves passionate about their subject. How can you expect a child to be interested? I mean, it's just basic that if you convey boredom, boredom is conveyed.
So this is a tough thing to change. My colleague, Robert Pandisio, will often remind me there's almost 4 million teachers in America.
Yes.
It's kind of hard to turn that battleship around.
Yeah.
Do you think we have the teachers
have the teachers if you opened up the subject matter, right, and began to think about education as exciting because it really engages with questions worth asking across the subject matters. And people always, when I say that, they sort of say, oh, Steiner's becoming a constructivist, right? Student-based learning, right? The whole child. No, one's demands for that much richer set of investigations should be absolutely rigorous, right? One's tests should be rigorous, but one should not be just endlessly redoing a 16th century curriculum.
So this brings to mind something that you've written before. I'm going to read this. This is in David Steiner's voice, which I will not invoke the accent. When I traveled in Europe and the Middle East and would ask middle and high school teachers why they taught, they would say, because I fell in love with literature, or I love math, or I adore science and I really want to take it to my students and discover it together. But when I was commissioner and I asked teachers across New York State the same question, they would answer, because we love children. And to love children is not to love the content that one is going to teach them. And it leaves me with questions I do not know how to answer. And I think there's something similar here with sort of the distractors you were talking about. The SEL, the grit, the growth mindset. Teachers seem to be more interested maybe in the caring, custodial part of the profession than the academic part.
And I want to say, because it's very important, I understand why. And when you look at, for example, the life of a kid in many parts of Baltimore, where I live, is it surprising that teachers' first instinct is to worry about whether the kids had enough to eat, right? Whether the kids had their inoculation, whether the kid can go home to a safe space, right? This isn't made up. It isn't that teachers, you know, love to be the person who's trying to right the world's wrongs. It is the truth that every social, political, and economic issue we have comes home to rest at the schoolhouse door. So teachers do find themselves having to try to do everything. They do want to help mentally with mental health. They want to be social workers. They want to be coaches. They want to be the in loco parentis, right? They want, and then finally, they want to teach math. Right?
After all that's rough.
After all that, right? And in many ways and in many cases, and I've seen it, they never get there.
Do you think at some point along the way, the idea of content in what you're teaching
right.
just became thought of as sort of actually unintellectual yeah. or sort of old-fashioned and stodgy? Yes. Like, look, this is not what people in universities are doing.
Right.
Memorizing doesn't get your thinking skills higher.
Right.
Having students learn basic facts and overtly strict environments isn't going to help them. I mean,
I agree, but it's dead wrong. So when Chalmeda, in that vast book, right, goes out into America to find examples of great learning and teaching and learning, what does he find? That the kids who are standing up on stage, having memorized their parts, right, are passionate about getting it right. And the phrase we should be using instead of memorization is learn by heart. Think about that phrase, right? Learn by heart. Have you ever seen the pride of a child when they can recite, when they can act, when they can play a musical piece well? That's earned self-esteem. How dare we define that as something lower than learning?
Learn by heart. That's good branding, David. That is some good branding. You were the dean of the Ed School. How much of these problems, I don't want to just like bash on Ed schools,
no.
but I think it's fair to say that our schools have some complicated, I don't know, set of pathologies. They're sort of locked into the structures. And to some degree, Ed schools either actively or passively keep these things locked in. How much of this is tied up in Ed schools?
I think we get the Ed schools we deserve. I'm now privileged to be at Johns Hopkins, which has this extraordinary access to world-class engineering, world-class science, world-class medicine. And I listen to the envy of my colleagues, right, as they look at the kind of support and the kind of really edge-pressing, frontier-moving work that's happening next door. And the hope is that at a place like Johns Hopkins, we can begin to think again about what it means to learn effectively, what it means to prepare teachers effectively. But it isn't right now, the tail is pretty small to wag a very large dog, where the dog is the rest of the system.
So what if you tried to turn it around yeah. from an Ed school? You can pick your Ed school, your imaginary yeah. Ed school that you now have control over. And you say, you know, we are going to chase the pursuit of teaching a set of content that we see as good for all kids,
right.
not just an elite education. And we're going to push that out through our Ed school. Would that just
right,
would there be any purchase there?
Yes, but it has to be linked to the skill of teaching. Right. We know, we've had good research on this, that if you just plonk a good curriculum in front of teachers, A, many of them don't believe their kids can learn it. Right. B, they haven't been taught how to teach it effectively. There's a huge multiplier effect if you teach good stuff well.
Right.
And in fact, there's an argument for saying good education is just that, the effective teaching of strong material. Right. So I would love it if we prepared the math teacher to teach a couple of math concepts, right, brilliantly, right? Do it backwards in front of the camera, right, till you're really at home in it, like an actor with a part, right? And a teacher to deal with real world consequences in clinical settings. How do you manage it, right? While still bringing this text to life, this problem to life, this scientific process to life. It could be done. And I don't think it would bar those teachers from employment, but there's no incentive to do it, right? One of the great problems, and we can close with this on teacher prep, is that it really doesn't matter where your degree is from. Which, if you think about it, is kind of a condemnation of the profession, because it's saying we don't really think there's a difference between strong teacher prep and weak teacher prep, right? It's just a piece of paper.
So in your book, A Nation of Thought, you start by recalling two different experiences, seeing students learn Shakespeare. Just build on that a little bit. What was
this got me into a lot of trouble with one of my very best friends and a person I admire as much as anyone in American education, Norman Atkins, who was seminal in creating Uncommon Schools. I went to see a school with my deputy commissioner, John King, who became U.S. Secretary of Education, now Chancellor at SUNY, in Buffalo. And we saw the worst of the worst. We saw in a class that had clearly been picked to impress me because it was about Shakespeare, but it had nothing to do with the text. It was a mindless activity. And John was as angry as I was. I mean, we were both, and we talked about this afterwards, this close to sort of taking over the class, right? Then sometime later, after I had become stopped becoming commissioner, I had the chance to go with Norman to one of his high schools that had wonderful results in Newark, New Jersey. And again, to a Shakespeare class. Right? And in one sense, the difference was profound, right? The students were courteous to each other. They were asking each other questions. They were clearly talking about the text, right? But the questions, in my judgment, were sophomoric. I don't mean that they were at the level of sophomores at college. Right. I mean they were at the level of who is telling the truth and who is lying in this act of Shakespeare, right? And this was Macbeth, and there are profoundly important and interesting themes in what they were reading. Themes about fate and free will and chance and moral guilt. And I complained to Norman afterwards. And he was, and it's rare for Norman and rare in our friendship, he was quite angry at me and accused me of being an Oxford snob and saying I didn't understand that these kids had siblings in jail, that what I'd seen was a miracle. And I still believe that they were being undertaught and underchallenged.
Because they were missing the spirit of Shakespeare in Macbeth,
yes,
right?
Yes, exactly. And I don't believe that it was patronizing to say we could do better.
What is your take? I think this is related on the state of the humanities in the country, not just our schools, yeah. In the country. Like, you can't build in schools on a foundation that is crumbling.
And, right.
And so, no,
I grew up in a
I mean, you're the Oxford snob. You tell me, right?
Right. I grew up in a very, very privileged home. There were 20,000 books, and my father and mother were both extremely distinguished academics. My father was a very well-known writer and critic for The New Yorker for many years. He said to me, just before he died, and I was complaining about the humanities in America, he said, David, why do you think the humanities should go on forever? They've had 23 good centuries. He said, it's over. He said, this is the age of science. He said, don't be sentimental, right? And I look at the data from universities, and I see that there's a complete collapse in the percentage of freshmen going, you know, sophomores choosing to major in the humanities. And at the same time, I go to a classical charter school, and we all know the politics there are complicated, and it wouldn't be my way of doing the classics, right? Or I go to a core knowledge school, and I see these students working with important ideas, right? And they're loving it. And I'm saying to myself, is it the humanities that have died, or is it our capacity to embrace the humanities that has died? And maybe it doesn't make any difference. They're dead or they're dying, right? I think that when you give children the chance to grapple with music, with art, with poetry, with beautiful literature, right? They actually love it. When you ask students years later who went to university and liberal arts colleges, what do they remember? They remember that professor who introduced them to that great text when everything else is forgotten. This isn't sentimental. This is empirical, right? So if we are closing the book, literally, on the humanities, then so much the worse for our children, right? People say, well, you know, children should only read what's relevant to their immediate cultures. If that were true, then Harry Potter would not have sold more than 10 copies. Children love to inhabit other worlds, right? They love to be in a world of knights and dragons and witches and sorcerers, and they're alive for novelty and also for things that challenge them and make them think. That's what it means to be human. I often think that animals can do a lot of things, right? They can communicate, whales again. They can build homes. They can gather nuts. They can clearly reproduce. They can be loyal to their mates. Just look at penguins. The one thing, so far as we know, that they don't have is the capacity for conceptual thought. If we don't nurture that in our education system, then what the heck are we doing? Yes, perhaps we're preparing the worker, though, frankly, we're doing not a very good job of that, right?
Poorly.
Right? Oh, we're preparing the citizen. Really? We're not doing a very good job of that either, since, right, the level of civic discourse seems to be reaching hitherto unknown regions. So it's not like we're doing great on the things we think we're supposed to be doing. But the most fundamental of all, the fundamental promise, and this, I suppose, is my core belief after far too many decades in this field, that the thing that matters most is our capacity to have informed thought. When you're alone, and we're more alone in our thoughts than we probably are with other people, if you think about a lifetime, what is the furnishing of your mind? What's there? What are you communicating with when you're talking to yourself, when you're thinking? I look at the American education system and I worry.
So we're talking a good bit about literature where the humanities is gone, and that's true. But on top of that, I think that there's just another aspect that I want to ask about specifically. And this is not about critical thinking.
Right.
That's one way to put it. But just rhetoric, making arguments, yes. Weighing evidence.
Yes.
And now I will tell you one thing that I do believe that adolescents are interested in, and that is arguing.
Yes.
I know this from personal experience and as my experience as a teacher, but the ability to weigh evidence, to advance a thesis, to prosecute the case.
Right.
This can be done in history or in philosophy or any
or
number
science,
of spheres
by the
or
way.
Science.
Yes.
But so you can defend sort of the part of literature in the liberal arts, but what about just the fate of rhetoric? Is it worse? Because you could make the claim, actually, we're still doing that.
No, absolutely. And it takes me back to my point about Nelson Mandela, right? Why does he occupy the role of Creon, right? Why does this person who's been thrown in jail by the South African apartheid structures, right, choose the rhetoric of a tyrant to understand it? Right? To be inside it, to be in an argument, to grapple with it. Children love to do that. Our problem is that we tend to overformalize it. It's very interesting, the difference between debate in England, and I had the privilege of being part of the Oxford Union Society, one of the more well-known ancient, right? One could say decrepit, but I won't, debating societies in England, and the American debating system, which is much more done on sort of scientific or quasi-scientific, right? Whereas the power of debate in an English debating system is the power to persuade, right? So you can't make facts up. You're going to fall on your face. So in that sense, it has to be informed. But it's also about the passion. It's also about the rhetoric in the ancient sense, right, of the ability to move your audience. And again, there seems to be a fear of that here. It's almost like, let's keep it clean. Let's keep it, right, like it's in a lab. Let's make it dry. We're very frightened in this society right now. We're frightened of offense. We're frightened of, you know, oh my goodness, I didn't mean to upset you. Where is the human right not to be upset? I mean, education, if it's worth anything, is going to involve your reading things that upset you. The human condition is upsetting, right? Eternity lasts an awfully long time. And if you're not a believer or a Christian believer, that's a pretty tough prospect, right? Finitude is tough. An education that doesn't introduce you to the human condition of mortality is fake. Science is about that. Literature is about that. Art is about that. So we're walking on eggshells. You can't teach passionately while you're walking on an eggshell.
So I'll go out with the last question. Do you think your father was correct? Is this the age of science and the humanities are dead? And if so, are you willing to go down with the ship?
As long as there's a classroom, a school, a child that is able to read something that's profound, disturbing, exciting, interesting, there's always hope. Always. You know, in my tradition, the Jewish tradition, if you save one soul, right, you save the world entire. And you watch what a really fine teacher can do in any circumstance. I had the privilege of being in Tbilisi, Georgia, after the Soviets pulled everything out. And there were no roofs on the schools. There were bomb craters. There had been no curriculum in the Georgian languages, which included Mongrelian, Ossetian, right, Abkhazian. Those teachers were teaching by heart with no materials. But boy, that was, even with translating for me, I could see it, right, in the children. We watch newsreels from all over the world, Afghanistan, right, the tears pouring down the children's faces of the girls because they can't be in school. How dare we not teach with passion.
Thanks for listening to The Report Card with Nat Malkus, and special thanks to our guest, David Steiner. We'll include a link to A Nation at Thought and some of David's other work in the show notes. Also, thanks to our producer, Ellie Lucas. He makes this podcast possible. Remember, you can subscribe to The Report Card on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And when you're there, take a moment to leave us a review so other people will find the show. As always, send us your comments, questions, or topic suggestions to ed.podcast@aei.org. That's it for this episode. I'm Nat Malkus.